Let's take our Bibles and open to John, the Gospel of John, and we'll continue the study that we began 3 weeks ago. We spent the last couple of weeks looking at an overview of the Gospel of John, trying to look at the structure of the Gospel. And there were six numbers that I gave to you last week that I said are sort of a little mnemonic key, a little memory trick key to keeping the structure of the Gospel in your mind. You know, when you're reading something as large as the Gospel of John, although it's not a long book compared to other books, when you're reading something that large, it's good to have a little roadmap in your mind while you're reading so you know where you're going and what the author's going to do, what's he going to say, how the book is divided up, and so forth. Can anybody tell me what those numbers are? What are the numbers that I gave you last week? Remember what they were? 18. You can cheat. It's okay. You can look. 18, 13, 20, 21. And then the next two numbers are very similar to 20 and 21. 30 and 31. Okay. Okay, so 18, 13, 20, 21, 30, and 31. Now, what does that have to do with anything? Okay, John Lewis is going to give us the structure of John now using those numbers because he's laughing at me. Does anyone want to take a stab at this? What does number 18 have to do with?
John 1, 1 through 18.
John 1, 1 through 18 is what?
It's discussing creation.
Okay, what do we call this, though? What's the point of those chapters? Yeah, it's the prologue or the introduction, okay, which is what we're going to start digging into this morning, all right? You can use the word prologue, you can use the word introduction, or you can say what Chip said. These are the beginning ideas of John. He's really in this prologue, and we're going to see this more next week when we get into it. What he's really doing is exploring all the themes as he introduces, as he sets up the gospel, that he's going to talk about in the rest of the chapter. So it's really interesting. We'll see a little bit of that as we get started in it this morning. But then I gave you the number 13. What does that have to do with? Number of chapters.
Beginning of the second verse.
Okay, all right.
Up to 13 is Act 1.
Okay, Act 1. Okay, the Book of Signs. All right. We can. What's that now? Oh, do you? Okay. Well, we'll have a contest afterwards, maybe, okay? But yeah, take a poll. We've got two books in John. The first is commonly called the Book of Signs because there are how many signs in that first book? How many named public signs? How many?
Seven.
Okay, the way we're looking at it, seven. The water turned to wine, the what? What's the second one? It's not a miracle. The temple clearing, nobleman's son sick at Capernaum, the feeding of the multitudes, etc. And then finally you get to the last climactic sign, which is the raising of Lazarus. And it goes through chapter 12. That's why I gave you chapter 13, because that starts the second book. At the end of chapter 12, John explains that after seeing all of these signs, the people still rejected Jesus as Messiah. And as soon as chapter 12 is over, Jesus Christ begins gathering his own together, and instead of these public meetings, public proclamations, public ministries, you begin to see everything done in private as Jesus Christ begins to prepare a new community, which becomes the church, and then dies and rises again to redeem that new community. And then finally, you come to the end of John, which the last chapter we call the epilogue, or it's the conclusion. All the Gospels, all the other three Gospels end with the resurrection. John gives one more chapter and shows Jesus Christ sort of gathering his disciples together again and giving them their mission that they're supposed to have now that he is risen from the dead. So we're just talking about the structure, though. So chapter 1, 1 through 18, that's why the number 18 is significant. That's the prologue. The rest of chapter 1 all the way through chapter 12, which is why the number 13 is important because it's the next chapter, is Act 1, or the first book, the Book of Signs. Starting in chapter 13, then, all the way through chapter what is the second book?
20.
Chapter 20, okay? And then finally, you have chapter 21, which is the epilogue, or the conclusion. What do the numbers 30 and 31 have to do with? Why are they important? Okay, what is the reference then for the purpose of the book?
31.
Which chapter?
20.
Yeah, 20, 30, and 31. All right? And which is, that's the end of chapter 20, which is one of the signals to us that chapter 21 is an addition. It's an add-on. It's an epilogue. Because he climaxes his literary purpose in the book at the end of chapter 20 with, hey, there are a lot of other signs which Jesus did. And notice he uses the word signs, semeion, not the word miracles or works. Many other signs truly did Jesus that are not written in this book, but these are written that you might what? Know. Christ is the Jesus Christ is the what? Son of the living God. And that believing you might what?
Have
life through his name. Right. And there are a lot of times we're reading books and epistles, and an author will say, you know, here's this verse sort of capsulizes the purpose of this book. I've done this with Hebrews. I've done it tentatively. I've been using Hebrews 4, 14, 15, and 16, mostly 16, as sort of the one verse that sort of summarizes everything that's in Hebrews. But that's not because the author said, aha, I'm going to include something here that capsulizes everything I'm going to say. No. He doesn't do that. But it does. He does seem to capture everything in that one little text. But that's my observation, or another author's observation. But in John, he tells us exactly why he was writing it. He lays it out for us. And so that is a clue to what he's doing in the whole book. Many other signs did Jesus. Oh, so John's been talking about signs. Where are they? Oh, we find seven of them. Seven signs, seven things that Jesus does that are called signs by John in the gospel. And they point to Jesus. And you read the first one, the water turned to wine, you find all the purposes of a sign. You find that the sign is public. You find that it is called a sign by John, and you find that it instills belief in those who see it, and it brings glory to Jesus Christ. That was the purpose of the signs. But in spite of those things, in spite of the fact that it brings glory to Christ and points to him as salvation, he was rejected for those signs at the end of chapter 12. And then we start chapter 13 for the rest of the book. So that is the structure of John. And what I'm going to do this morning then is begin to talk about John's prologue. We're going to introduce it, and then I'm going to spend the bulk of the time talking about these verses at the beginning of John that we're challenged on sometimes. And I'm going to try to lay this out for you. This will be the most technical lesson, but I'm going to try to make it very simple. And I've given you the handout just so we can track together. But I want to show you, because we have a lot of discussion about this particular verse often, exactly what is going on, so that you have assurance that our beliefs are defensible when we are challenged according to what we believe. So, John's prologue, look at your handout there, verses 1 through 18. The first words of John's gospel in the beginning forge a link with the beginning of the entire Bible. Genesis 1:1, in the beginning, God. Compare the opening chapters of Genesis with the prologue in John, noting the parallels and similarities. So here's what I want you to do. I'm not going to divide you into groups like I did a couple weeks ago. But as you're sitting there with your family or by yourself or in a group, talk about this together. I want you to take John 1, 1 through 18, which I have written out for you here, and take your Bible and open it to Genesis 1, 2, and 3. So you can cheat. I'll let you look at Genesis. But I want you to sort of scan over those chapters, and I want you to look at the prologue together. And I want you to see if you can find some similarities other than in the beginning that serve as a link between the beginning of Genesis and John 1, 1 through 18. Does that make sense? Look at Genesis 1 through 3. Just sort of scan that over. What words jump out that are similar? Or what ideas do you know of that are similar? I don't have a list up here of all the right answers or anything like that. There are probably things that you saw that have never even occurred to me as you look at these first two. But because John obviously is forging a link between these two books. You've got the beginning of salvation, Jesus Christ, and you've got the beginning of the world. And remember that Paul uses the creation event as an illustration of salvation. He says, the God who said, let light be, literally is what it says, let light shine out of darkness, is the same who said, let light be in our hearts to give us the knowledge of the glory of Jesus Christ. And so the creation event is one illustration of the recreation event that happens when we trust in the Lord Jesus Christ. And so there are some really unique parallels that we see between these two things, all right? What's one of them that you might have noticed? John.
John, in verse 4, says, in him was life, and the life was the light of men. And in Genesis 1:27, it says, God created him in his own image, in the image of God, he created him.
Okay.
And I think that those two go together.
Okay, good, excellent, all right? You've got life. The creation of life in Genesis 1:1-3. And you've got life being created, new life being created in John 1:1-18. Okay, what's something else? We've got life. What else?
Darkness and light.
Okay, light and darkness. All right, do you want to elaborate on that?
Well, I just wrote that all was dark.
Okay.
But then John said, Christ is the light.
Okay. All right. So Christ, so we have light and darkness, notice those motifs. And notice you've got you start with darkness in Genesis, and there's let there be light, and then there's light. Then you come back into darkness in Genesis 3. What does John say about darkness and light, and what men by themselves, what men and women on their own, left to themselves, what do they like? Do they rather have the light or the darkness?
The
darkness. They love darkness rather than light. Jesus Christ came to reverse that in our hearts so that we love light rather than darkness. So light and darkness, a lot of interesting parallels between those two ideas. All right? In the back, over here. Did I see a hand? Yes.
The Word, God spake. But what's interesting, 1 John 1 as well.
Mm-hmm.
The Word of life in the beginning.
Yep. Okay, you've got the Word. What is the first activity that we actually know of with God in Genesis? And God said, right? Then you have Jesus Christ, the living Word, in John 1. Then you come to Hebrews, and it says, God has now what? Spoken by his son, or through his son, by means of his son. And later on in John 1:1-18, it says that nobody has seen God in any time, but Jesus Christ, he has declared him. He has made him known. He has spoken him out. And we'll have to look, rip apart that verse a little bit. There's some interesting things there when we get to that. Okay? Something else. Very good. Yes, sir. Greg.
You have the gospel in Genesis 3:15 and in John 1:12.
Okay, that's
yep. There's somebody coming afterwards going to be able to save you, and in 1:12 it says, "But as many as received him, here he is; he's here."
Okay, that excellent. So what he's talking about is Genesis 3:15, where in the prophecy of the curse, he tells the woman that the serpent will bruise the heel of your seed, and it's one seed there. What is the seed or the offspring that God is talking about there? Well, prophetically, it's referring to Jesus Christ. And it says that the serpent will bruise his heel, but the seed will bruise the serpent's head. He will give him a crushing blow. And so we see the gospel portrayed in, especially in 1:12, but as many as received him, to then gave he the power to become the children of God, the sons of God. Okay? Very good. What else? Chip.
Light and the Word in Genesis 1:3, he says, God, or 4, God saw that the light was good, and he separated the light from the darkness.
Mm-hmm.
And in John, in 1:5, the light, which is it's reflecting Jesus as the light and the light, shines in darkness, and darkness did not comprehend it. Well, lack of comprehension is a separation as well. That's kind
of parallel. Interesting. The separation of the light and darkness. Excellent. Very good. I never thought about that before. There's another parallel. Lots of things you can do with light and darkness in those two, however. Okay? Anything else? Okay. Let me ask you one other question, a follow-up question. And that is this. In what you already know of the Gospel of John, can you see what John is going to do with some of those themes later on in the Gospel? For instance, let's take the theme of life. Is there anything in John that you can think of where life is mentioned? Does he ever bring that up again? Okay, eternal life. All right? I am the way, the truth, and the life. Life is a huge theme in the Gospel of John. What about light? What does Jesus say later about himself?
I
am the light of the world. And what you're seeing here is a trajectory of ideas that we read them in John 1:1-18, and we can trace them through the Gospel. What we're going to do next week is I'm going to give you a handout which lists all the major themes. It might not be exhaustive. You can probably come up with more when you see this. And we're going to just illustrate tracing them as we study what he's saying in this prologue. And then, as I've told you, as our teachers teach through this, we're going to keep our eye on the structure and our eye on what we've said in these opening sessions and show how, and keep coming back to those ideas and show how they play out through the rest of the Gospel. But let's go here to one idea, the beginning idea here in this connection between John 1:1-18 and Genesis 1-3. Look at the back of your handout where it says, when John writes in the beginning, his readers familiar with Genesis 1:1 expect the next word to be God. In the beginning, God. But instead, John supplies, in the beginning was the Word. And as the prologue unfolds, the reader discovers that the Word is none other than Jesus Christ, and he is the subject of John's gospel. In other words, John begins by putting Jesus Christ, both historically and theologically, in his proper place. Jesus is the eternal God. Historically, he was there at the beginning. In fact, John will go on to say that the world was made by him. That's verse 3. Theologically, since he was there at the beginning, he existed before the beginning. In other words, when the beginning came, he already was there. He is the great I Am, John 8:58 shows him declaring. He already was. However, it says here, the traditional understanding that John 1:1-2 affirms the deity of Christ is sometimes challenged today. These are the verses that say, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The same was in the beginning with God. And that is challenged sometimes today. Sometimes people will come to your doors, always in pairs, and they will have some literature. And if you don't ask insightful questions, sometimes you'll get the idea that they believe the same thing you do. And why don't you just go down to their church and meet with them? It might as well. It's closer. And after all, they're all the same. But you start asking them questions about the Son of God, Jesus Christ. And that will start clearing away the first things they say to get at the heart of what they really believe. Look there under the title, The Deity of Christ in John 1:1-2. And I've given you a traditional translation, the King James translation, which is very similar to a lot of the other translations you'll see of John 1:1. It's very hard to translate it any other way. It's so simple. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The same was in the beginning with God. Now look at this next translation. It's the New World Translation. That's the Jehovah's Witness translation. What is the key difference in this translation? Yeah, you notice it right away. Mm-hmm. How long ago?
About 15 years ago.
Okay.
We had the CES doctrines present, and we had to debate that. And this, we actually had the CES guys in the office with Bill Jones discussing this exact verse and the way they translate it.
Okay. I remember hearing about that. Well, 15 years is long overdue, so we're gonna go through it again here. And when we're done this morning, I don't have a goal in mind where everybody's going to be able to parrot back everything that I'm going to tell you. What I want you to help you understand is that is what the issue is here, and that our belief is defensible based on what the text of Scripture says. Yes, sir?
Could you repeat what happened 15 years ago?
We had a couple that had been attending here that we found out, at least the husband, did not agree with the idea that Jesus Christ was God himself. And so it was handled very well by this church, and the pastor counseled them for several weeks, and Chip knows all the details on that. It was one of these examples before I came of, I think, our church following very, very biblical patterns of trying to rescue people, not just trying to push them out the door. But eventually they did leave because they would not change the doctrinal position. And so that there's a little bit of history here with this church, although it was not a Jehovah's Witness couple. Now, I've given you here on the handout with great trepidation the actual Greek text. And then I gave you a transliteration so you can know how to pronounce these words. None of that really matters that you know that, but I want you to be able to see very clearly that I'm not just pulling this out of the air. I'm trying to show you exactly what the evidence is. Whenever you have a discussion and a debate, if you have two people who are trying to reason well, it's usually not that you're looking at different evidence. It's how you're interpreting the evidence. Many of you the other week saw the Bill Nye and Ken Ham debate, and Ken Ham made a valid point. We're not looking at different evidence. We're all looking at the same evidence, the strata layers, and the light from the stars and the distance and this sort of thing. What does it all mean is the question. They're all looking at the same things for evidence. And this is the evidence, is what you're looking at. This is the text of Scripture. And how we interpret it is determinative of whether or not we come up with the word was a God or the word was the God. All right? And I want to take you through this really carefully. And keep your eyes on this this rendition of the Greek text and the English translation there. And I think you'll understand what I'm going to try to teach you here this morning. Now, I'm going to read the English. It's very painful. I gave you a very strict, literal translation. I didn't smooth it out at all. And I want to make a point with you. This is not a good translation. Some of you will see this and say, well, it seems to me the most excellent translation because it doesn't add anything to the original text and it doesn't take away anything from the original text. But you have to understand, when you translate from one language to another, it's impossible to have exactly a one-to-one correspondence, every word in Greek corresponding to every word in English across the board, so that there's one word in English for every word in Greek. Sometimes we have Greek verbs where there's not a verb in English that really corresponds to it, and we have to think of a few words to come up with the whole idea. We'll talk about the article, the, or a. That's the whole point of the. I'm going to lecture you. I'm going to give you a 15-minute lecture on the article. Okay, that sounds really exciting, doesn't it? But that's the whole point. Is it a God or the God? The article matters. Is it a definite article, the God? Or is it an indefinite article, a God? Our theology hinges on an article here. In this verse, and so it's very important. But articles in Greek don't work the same way as they do in English. There's similarities, but they don't work exactly the same way. So notice here the translation. In beginning was the Word, and the Word was with the God. And notice I made it a small g because there's no capital TH, or I'm sorry, there's no, well, the word for God is theon, it's a TH sound. but it's not capitalized in Greek. The Word was with the God, and God was the Word. That's the literal order, and that's just a one-to-one correspondence of each of the words. Then it says, same was in beginning with the God. That's how we get the same was in the beginning with God. The same was in the beginning with God is a really good translation of these words. Same was in beginning with God is not a good translation because it doesn't give you the sense of what the Greek is saying, you see. A one-to-one correspondence, every Greek word corresponding to an English word, does not always give us a good translation. It just helps us understand what is happening in the Greek language. So, first of all, we're looking at the Greek sentence structure. And that's why I want you to keep your eyes here right on this on this Greek that I have on the page. First of all, we notice that articles in Greek do not function exactly the same as articles in English. So sometimes it's natural for us to use an article where Greek does not. We don't say in beginning. That it strikes our ears funny. We say in the beginning. In English, it's natural for us to use an article, the, in front of the word beginning. Nobody thinks a thing of it. Not in Greek. That's not good Greek. But the article the, we use in English. So sometimes it's natural for us to use the article where Greek does not, in the beginning. Or look at the beginning of verse 2. Same was in beginning with God. In English, we would say the same or the same thing, the same person, the same word was in the beginning with God. Secondly, sometimes it is natural for us not to use an article where Greek does. Notice it says here in that middle phrase in the top, and the word was with the God. We don't say it that way. It's more natural for us to say, and the word was with God. The reason the word the is there in Greek is because this is it's using the word the to point back to the subject that it was talking about. So we could read it this way, and the word was with this God. And the word was God. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with this God that we're going to talk about, and God was the Word. So that might sound a little confusing, but all the point is, the only point I'm making here is the article is used differently in Greek. So we can't say, well, in English we do this and expect that to be a good argument. We have to argue the way Greek uses the articles. Okay, so secondly, notice the phrase in question. The Word was God. Literally, it says the God was the Word. Is it the Word was God or the Word was a God? Notice that before the word God, if you're looking at that last phrase on the top part there, before the word God, there is no definite article. See that? And God was the Word. There's no article before God. But notice there is not an article there at all. There's no a, and there's no the. Guess what? There's no a in the Greek language. You know that? There is no indefinite article in the Greek language. I can say, sit in the pew, and you would say, well, which pew? Because I'm obviously pointing to a definite one that I have. And I might tell one of my kids, well, sit in that pew. That's a real definite article. Sit in this one. All right? But if I say, come in here and sit in a pew, you just sit in any one, because I'm not pointing at one in particular. Greek does not have a word that means something indefinite. It doesn't have an a or an like we have in English. And so notice that right away. There's no word for a. So if a Jehovah's Witness comes to your house and says, now you don't understand. In John 1:1, it doesn't say the Word was God. It says the Word was a God. Now, I'm never at the right place at the right time. I've had a handful of these conversations over the past years because what I would love to do is take out my Nestle-Aland version 28 Greek New Testament and hand it to them and say, okay, show me what you're talking about. Well, with most of them, you could hand it to them upside down and they wouldn't know, you know, what they were doing. They're told these things. But they cannot open the text and point to the word a, to the letter A or the indefinite article a God and show you that it's not there. It doesn't say the God and it doesn't say a God. There's just nothing there. And that's the way the Greek language works. It depends on the context, whether or not it's the or whether it's a. So why then do the translators of the New World Translation render the phrase, the word was a God? Here's what they argue. Okay, ready for this? I hope I'm making some sense of here. They argue that, listen, when it doesn't have the article, if it doesn't say the God, or the light, or the word, then you translate it a light, a word, a whatever. If it doesn't have the definite article, then it must be indefinite. And here, if you'll look, you'll notice it says, and God was the word. It doesn't say the God, so therefore it's a God was the word. In other words, the word was a God. Now, we've already seen that Greek articles do not function the same way as English articles. Are they right about this principle, that if you don't have a definite article in front of the word, it must be a instead of the? Well, you know I'm going to conclude no, that's not right. But I want you to notice here how inconsistently the New World Translation applies this principle. If you read the New World Translation, it should say in their translation in verse 1, in a beginning was the word. Notice you don't have the article in front of the word beginning. It should say in a beginning, but it doesn't. It says in the beginning in their translation. Oh, surprise. How do they get that then? All right, verse 4, which you don't have in your handout, but it says in him was life. That's a noun. It doesn't have an article. It doesn't say in him was the life. It says in him was life. He should translate it in him was a life, according to their principle, but they don't. They don't put the A there. They just have the same thing we have. In him was a life. If we read further on in John 1, 1 through 18, here is verse 6. There was a man sent from God. His name was John. Well, the word God here in verse 6 does not have the article. They should be translating this, there was a man sent from a God, but they don't. They have, there was a man sent from God. Verse 18, no one has seen God at any time. Does the Greek have the article? No, it has no article. It simply says, no one has seen God. According to their principle, they should be translating this, no one has seen a God. But they don't. It says, no one has seen God. And I could go on and on and on. The point is, the principle they use to say it must be a God, they are not consistent with and do not apply in almost every other instance. And so we can see the inconsistency again and again. And this observation alone should alert us to the possibility that their translation is not linguistically driven. It is theologically driven. They are simply supporting their interpretation when they use this. Now, so far, all of this talk about a Greek article and so forth should raise several questions. But one of the main ones is this. So how do we know if a word is indefinite in Greek? If it doesn't have the article and we don't have a Greek word a or an, how do we know if we should have an a in front of the word? Well, first of all, here's a principle for you. If a noun has a definite article in front of it, if it has the word, here it is, the word ha is the one here in verse 1. By the way, the definite article in Greek has all kinds of different forms. It changes into all kinds of forms depending on what word it's modifying. But if it has the definite article, guess what? It's never indefinite. If it says the God, then it's a definite noun. So you know what's definite very clearly if you have the article. But if you don't have the article, you have three choices. Okay? Now listen carefully. If it doesn't have the article, if it's just God by itself, not the God, but just God, it very well could still be definite. For example, proper names in the Greek New Testament never have the article in front of them, but proper names are always definite. For instance, there's only one John who's writing this gospel, and there's only one John the Baptist that's coming to declare Jesus Christ. And John, the word John doesn't have an article in front of it. The Greek doesn't make it definite, but we know it is. All names are automatically that way. And so there are a lot of words like that we know they're definite, even though it doesn't have the article in front of it. If a noun does not have an article in front of it, It could be indefinite. It could be a light, a God. Yes, that is allowable in the grammar. But it depends on the context. There's one other choice. It could express the idea of quality if it doesn't have the article. If you have your Bibles there in John chapter 1, verse 4 once again says, "In him was life, and the life was the light of men." And what that's really saying there is, it doesn't have the life, it just has life. It's not saying in him was a life, or in him was the life necessarily. It's saying in him was life, or the quality of life. Or in him was light, we could say. He has the quality of light. And so if you think of the idea of quality, when you don't have the article, oftentimes that is what is going on. So, could you translate the phrase, "the word was a God"? Could you take this this last phrase on the top there, the one on the far right, "and God was the Word"? Could you translate that, "the Word was a God"? The answer is yes, you could, if you took it totally out of context and you just had those bare words on a page. But even then, it would not go with the normal rules of Greek grammar. I'm not going to go into the details here, but when you have one thing equals another, which is what you have here, you have one noun equals another. You have God equaling the Word. And you've got no article there on the first noun that comes before the verb. Almost always, you're not going to have the God, the Word was a God. It's almost always going to mean the Word was the God, or the Word had the quality of God, or the quality of deity, we could say. And so the grammar itself shows us this can't possibly be true. But lest you have to walk around with a bunch of Greek rules in your head, just the context alone tells us this cannot be Christ as a God. Let's look at the context for a second. Could it be a God in the context? Let's look at the historical context. In fact, I put this at the bottom of your handout. The historical context. What do we know about the author of John? What do we know about him? What was his religious background?
John was Jewish.
John was Jewish.
Monotheistic. The only monotheistic faith at the time.
I haven't checked out that fact, but that sounds good to me.
Mono means one.
Right. Oh, really? Okay. All right. I don't know if they. I don't know. It might have been the only monotheistic faith. I don't know, because there's some different ones in Greek that were monotheistic. The emperor, in fact, thought he was the only God. So that's one. But anyway, I'm being facetious there. But think about it for a second. Every Jewish child grew up, one of the first verses they learned are the Shema, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God, the Lord is one." Can you imagine a first century Jew writing a document where he suggests that there's more than one God? Almost impossible that that would happen, unless he was totally rejecting his religion. That was the foundation of their religion. There is one God, which implies one creator and one object of worship. And so historically, to suggest that an author would say there is a God and there is another God, it totally makes no sense. So in the context, it's already driving us against the translation, "the Word was a God." Chip?
Paradoxically, Jewish critics and Christians will point this and say, well, John is saying there's more than one God. There's the Father and the Son.
Yep.
How would you address that?
Which again, goes back to, here's the evidence, and it depends on what you're going to do with that evidence, how you're going to take it. Secondly, let's look at the literary context. In other words, what does John say about Jesus Christ the rest of the gospel? I have some verses to read to you. They're familiar to most of you, I'm sure, if not all of you. John 5, 18. John says, "This is why the Jews were seeking all the more to kill him, because not only was he breaking the Sabbath, but he was even calling God his own Father, making himself equal with God." In other words, they were trying to kill Jesus because he was saying things which made it seem like he was saying he was one with the Father. He was equal with God. And verse 23 of John 5 says that all may honor the Son just as they honor the Father. Whoever does not honor the Son does not honor the Father who sent him. Here's John 8:58. Jesus said to them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham was, I am." And they got the full implication of the I am from Exodus. And so verse 59 says, "So they picked up stones to throw at him." They knew exactly what he was saying. They wanted to stone him for blasphemy. Same thing in John 10:30 through 31. After Jesus says, "I and the Father are one," you can have a debate with people. Was he really making himself equal with God? Was he really saying he was God, or was he just saying he was in unity with the Father when he said, "I and the Father are one"? Well, whether or not you win that debate, all you have to do is look at verse 31, the next verse, and see what happened. As soon as he said that, it says the Jews picked up stones again to stone him. It was almost as if at a certain point in Jesus' ministry, whenever he came around, people were starting to look for stones because they knew he was going to start blaspheming when he talked about his relationship with the Father. In John 20:28, I think is one of the most remarkable statements. Thomas comes to Jesus Christ. Actually, Jesus comes into the midst of them because Thomas has been doubting. He says, "Put your finger in my hands," and he shows him his side. And what does Thomas say? "My Lord and my God." Let me read you that in Greek. "The Lord of me and the God of me." The Lord of me and the God of me. He is definitely calling Jesus Christ his Lord and his God in a definite sense. And this is a profound statement if you're going to argue against the traditional reading of John 1:1 and say that it is a God. In fact, do you know how Jehovah's Witnesses, at least some of them, handle John 20:28? They say that Thomas is not calling Jesus his Lord and God. Thomas is actually using Jehovah's name in vain. He was so shocked that it was Jesus that he swore in front of Jesus. No lie, no lie. That's what they say. In order to get around this idea that he'd actually be calling him Lord and God. The point is, in the literary context of the rest of the gospel, Jesus Christ is shown in so many remarkable ways to be one with the Father. And the suggestion of the whole gospel, not just this one verse, is that Jesus is God. Jesus is not the same person as God. Because you've got a distinction between God the Father and God the Son, but they are both God. The Holy Spirit is not the Father and is not the Son. The Son is not the Spirit or the Father. The Father is not the Spirit or the Son, but all three together are equally God. And the writing of John supports that idea. So, finally then, let's look at the grammatical context. And I'll wrap this up really quickly. Remember, there are three choices. If it doesn't say the God, there are three choices. It could still be definite. It could still be the God. Or it could be indefinite. It could be a God. Or it could be the idea of quality. Well, is it definite? If the article is implied here, if it's the God, then there would be no distinction between God the Father and the Word, when clearly John is making a distinction with these two personalities. Look at the middle phrase here of verse 1. It says, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God." All right? So you've got distinction here. You've got Word, and you've got God. And we read on and find out that when the New Testament is speaking of God, it's speaking specifically of God the Father in comparison to the Son. You don't have the distinction until the Son shows up in the New Testament. Because in the Old Testament, it's very hard to distinguish the Trinity. You know why? I mean, how do you distinguish one a holy, omnipotent, omniscient, everlasting being from another? They're so similar in their essence. But when Jesus Christ fleshes out God for all to see and points back to the Father, then we start seeing the distinctions between the personalities. And John right away says the Word was with God, and then he says the Word was God. They are distinct. They are separate personalities, but they are both God. And if we say the Word is the God here, it destroys that distinction. It doesn't make sense, in fact, in the whole context. So we know it can't be definite. Well, is it indefinite? Well, the historical and literary context already point to the fact that it can't be indefinite. So we can already conclude that. But the grammatical structure of the Greek phrase in question most naturally is translated, the word was God. And I've already explained that a little bit. It just doesn't make sense grammatically to have it any other way. The final option then we're left with in the Greek grammar is the option of quality. In other words, the phrase is intended to mean something like this. The word had the quality of deity. In fact, there may not be a more perfect way to say that God the Father is God and Jesus the Word is God, and yet they are two distinct persons. John is being very careful here, actually, in his language. The phrase theos en halagos, which we could translate deity was the Word, means that Jesus shared the essence of the Father so that what you can say about the Father, you can also say about the Son. That's the point. For example, both the Father and the Son are eternal because they were both in the beginning together. So when you're challenged about John 1:1, if anybody ever tries to tell you that this means the Word was a God, it's not simply a matter of how you read this particular phrase. To insist that the verse should be translated a God is to deny the historical and the literary and the grammatical context. It's just virtually impossible that it could be translated any other way than what we have it. And what we have come away appreciating is how John crafts this verse in order to protect both the distinction of the persons of God and the unity of the persons of God. And we come away knowing for sure that Jesus Christ is called God in John 1:1. There is no question. When you're approached by people, sometimes they seem very convincing. And they will twist your words sometimes or say, well, you just don't understand. Okay? Not true at all. And you know enough of what the Scripture says already by exercising a little critical thinking can destroy most of those arguments that they'll come up with.